welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined again by Phil Brynan and Joe Kirk. Hello, both of you.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
So, hello. So we spoke today about lawful basis. So the topic of the session is beyond consent, the different lawful basis for data processing. And it was a great turnout this week, wasn't it? I didn't expect it, but there was loads going on in the chat as ever.
Yeah,
over 100. Yeah.
Was there? All right, very good.
Yeah. So
we didn't get much beyond consent, though, did we? We did.
I know.
Get bogged down in consent, and we didn't cover off some of the really exciting stuff we wanted to do, so we'll have to put another session on. But anyway, I thought it was a good session, lots of engagement.
Yeah, no, we shot ourselves in the foot with the title, I think. But it reiterates, you know, the whole opinion around consent, and the aura around it as well. So obviously, so many people, that's the first thing they gravitate towards. They think that's the only lawful basis in a lot of instances, that you should only be using using personal data with consent and so on. But there is a lot, you know, so many other options in most instances.
You think
but here we are
listed at
on
the top.
Consent again.
Yeah. Do you think that's because it's listed at the top of the lawful basis and it's, you know, people just stop there and don't go beyond it?
It depends who you're talking to. Like you said in the session, Joe, you know, a lot of people who, you know, their information's being processed will complain because they've not consented to it and so on.
Yeah.
And I think it more comes to that just the idea of that you should only do things with permission rather than if there's another way that the law facilitates.
No, I tend to agree. We get it a lot, don't we, through the support desk where customers have had data subjects complaining, saying you've shared my personal details without my permission, you know, and they're trying to maybe get a bit of money out of the organization, but it doesn't quite work like that, does it, in all instances, actually? Yeah. In very, very few.
Yeah, we talked quite a bit about, again, facial recognition cameras, but there's some new stuff there that, you know, new guidelines from the European Data Protection Board, the French court have approved the use, the South Wales police had using body-worn facial recognition at the Beyoncé concert. And then we talked a bit about, which is quite interesting, kind of a court ruling, a European court ruling, on the difference between pseudonymization and anonymization. And Vicky came on and said that she'd had the exact opposite of the European stance from the ICO this week. So, yeah, again, interesting as practitioners, isn't there? There's this kind of areas of fairly, you know, small, I suppose, divergence, but, you know, will it grow? We had a brilliant one in the support desk, which I'll have to save till next week, where one of our customers has been sent your privacy notice doesn't comply with our policy from Google, and if you don't get it compliant, we're going to switch your services off, which I think related to cookies. But I wanted to raise that in the news, but we ran out of time. But
no,
we had a good session
about that one next week.
Yeah, we had a good session, and we talked a lot about consent. Sometimes I feel, have you ever listened to Gardener's Question Time?
No,
you surprise me, you two green fingered people. But sometimes I feel you know, I think it's great that people come on and ask us questions. I love it, and you know, I could do sessions where that's all we did, it would be brilliant.
Yeah,
but sometimes you feel like you're on Gardener's Question Time. You know, I've got a north facing garden of clay soil, you know, what should I put in there to give me some low winter coverage? I don't know, never seen the site.
yeah. No, I understand the reference, to be fair. A lot of people came with, you know, questions ready, didn't they? But with these kinds of things, it's hard, because it's hard to give advice without seeing all the facts
the
in front
context
of you.
Yeah,
of course.
We try, don't we? We do try. I mean,
it's just the typical, it depends. It depends on this, it depends on that.
Yeah, ultimately, I think people can get engaged with us, happy to engage outside of the podcast, aren't we, for anything that we haven't covered adequately or...
Yeah, I
whatever.
Mean, these are the kinds of things that we deal with on the support desk all the time, aren't they? So we're well versed, but obviously with the context and facts in front of us.
So we got a little bit beyond consent, didn't we? But not massively
bit,
so.
Yeah.
We did talk about legitimate interest. We talked quite a lot about contracts, didn't we? That was interesting, about your peppercorn.
Yeah, the new currency, King Charles's currency.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
What are we doing next week?
So next week is a GDPR radio session where we can talk about the many news items that you sent to us before the session. So we'll unpick them. And then following that, we'll look to put in a second session for lawful bases. So if anyone's got any questions and things that they'd like us to discuss on that, do, you know, get in contact with us. But for now, enjoy the session. Those who haven't joined us before, we usually start these sessions by just talking a little bit about what's been in the news in the week, and then we go into the main bulk of the session. So what have you seen, Phil and Joe?
I've seen a lot this week, and we've had some really interesting cases in the support desk as well, as I'm sure. So we could probably spend the whole session just talking about stuff in the news, but things that caught my eye. I don't know if you noticed, I don't use Facebook myself, but Facebook have launched a subscription service similar to Twitter, so you can pay £10 a month. I think, is it Twitter £9.99 one-off payment or something to get your blue tick? Well, Facebook.
I think that's monthly as well.
Oh, is it? Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. But one of the things you get as a fee payer is you get better security provisions. You get multi-factor authentication. I just wondered whether you were going to pay to get your Facebook accounts verified, and whether you think holding security measures as a kind of a subscription service is a good idea.
I'm not going to pay it. But it doesn't seem right, does it, really, to penalise people not to pay it, to have a weaker security posture on their Facebook profile. So I agree with you, Phil, that it's wrong to do that, definitely.
It's a bit odd. Seemed a bit odd to me. I don't know if everybody else has got any thoughts. Oh, Andy's saying that, I was telling you. Another thing I noticed, there's been quite a lot in the press on facial recognition technology. So the government are looking to deploy body-worn facial recognition cameras. And I read an article saying, you know, how far is this going to go, this surveillance society? And then I noticed that South Wales Police announced they're going to use live facial recognition in Cardiff again at the Beyoncé concert. If you remember, they last used it for the Speedway Grand Prix last year. But in 3 years ago, in Bridges v South Wales Police, they got lambasted for using... in fact, I think there's more of a critique of their DPIA than it was of actually the use of the technology. But that's quite interesting there. Then I saw that the French court had approved the use of facial recognition technology for the Olympics next year, which we talked about, didn't we, a few weeks ago, that it was being proposed. So that's been approved. And then I noticed that European Data Protection Board had issued guidelines a couple of weeks ago about the use of facial recognition technology in a law enforcement processing. So quite a lot going on in that area. And then we talked about that speed camera, and I don't know, sort of linking AI in as well. Yeah, this is just kind of, it's just gathering steam, isn't it?
Well, Fiona says in the chat here that facial recognition is slowly becoming the accepted norm, and it's scary. It's happening even quicker than I'd have thought, to be honest. Obviously, there's a lot of people that still have the concerns, especially you, Joe.
Yes, definitely.
But I think it's just absolutely snowballing. I don't know, maybe it's hot news and, you know, we see more of it. But
well, I think it's this kind of objection to the surveillance society. And what was interesting, though, I kind of pulled out that Bridges v South Wales Police judgment again to read through it, because that's quite an interesting judgment to read. And it talks about, you know, the inbuilt bias and, you know, some of the statistics of those people who were stopped, and some people have got these, they call them lambs, who've got faces with lots of common features, like a nose and two eyes and and they get kind of matched more frequently. But what was interesting was that according to what I read in this judgment, you know, which is probably right because it's being presented to the court as evidence, that most images, you know, they get scanned and then they get destroyed. So they don't sit on the system. They're not building up this database of faces, apparently. They're only looking for people of interest. And I think there was 245 people of interest they were looking for at this Speedway thing. So, yeah.
If something was to come about, you know, so, okay, they've scanned people's faces and then something happens, but it wasn't one of these people of interest. They can't then look back at that information to see who was.
Apparently not. Apparently it doesn't get retained, apparently.
Okay.
So if there's a match, it gets retained. And if there's not a match, it doesn't get retained. But then people who, you know, say that there's a lot of false positives and there's some people with features that the system can't yet distinguish easily enough from other people, and you know, these lambs, and
Sorry to interrupt, but the accuracy of these systems and this AI software, that it's not there yet, and we're still, you know, still implementing it, still using it in various ways. But even, I don't know, even, you know, as small scale as, you know, the subtitles that automatically you can add to a video that just aren't accurate. It's that's the smallest scale, obviously, yeah, but yeah, it's still happening. So I don't know.
And Cara, you know, Cara's saying, I didn't hear this on Radio 1. So that has, if it's been on the radio as well as in the legal and data protection type of press, and it's obviously big news, isn't it? But it's not just specific individuals due to their race, also females as well. Again, reading this judgment from Bridges v South Wales Police, saying that the system doesn't handle female images as well as it does male images. And that's, again, I think due to the training of it and the volume of images available.
Yeah, there's a documentary called Coded Bias on Netflix that talks about that. So with AI in terms of recognizing people and you know, replicating people and things like that, it's very much based on the outlook and the image of middle-aged white men, as far, you know, as far as it goes, the people who are coding these systems and so on. And it's really interesting. I recommend watching it.
I mean, I agree with Michael. I think it is kind of a scope creep, isn't it? Once it becomes established on the norm, and, you know, it was a coronation, you know, or a massive one-off event, and then it's, you know, a pop concert, and, you know, it's a thin end of a wedge to me.
Mm. I mean, body cams aren't a new thing, though, are they, really? But whether they previously did facial recognition, I guess, is the separate point here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I go watch football quite a bit, and often the police there will have body cameras on, and they'll be recording the fans and just observing inside the ground, looking out for bad behaviour. So I don't think it's anything new, but it's just, I suppose...
body worn cameras isn't, but linking it to facial recognition and AI is. And that's all it does, is it puts the cameras in amongst people, doesn't it?
Sure. What's the purpose of these things? So obviously, you said that at the speedway it was for
public order. I think they justify it with the speedway because I think the previous Grand Prix there was some disturbances.
Right.
I think actually there was a bomb. From memory, there was a bomb hoax. People, Cara might know better. I think there was a bomb hoax last time and for an event, and that was used as a justification for doing it last year at the speedway.
Okay.
And you'd think that, you know, the sad. Ariana Grande, you know, in Manchester, again, could be justification for this in a pop concert scenario, but where does it stop?
Yeah.
It's an interesting point Fiona's raising, you know, if you object to the use of facial recognition, you know, would you get a refund? I wouldn't have thought so. Go on, carry on.
No, I was just going to say that I've seen that the European Data Protection Board has issued guidance on data protection for small businesses. Have you had a look at it?
I did. There's some really good stuff there. There's some great. Did you have a look at it? There's some great videos. You know, really sure, impactful videos that really put things into an easy to understand format. I really liked that. Again, we could put the link in the chat.
I was going to find it.
But I did look at those and I thought, oh, this is really good. Good old European Data Protection Board.
it's well timed actually, because I don't know about you guys, but I tend to struggle for any sort of guidance for small businesses from the ICO. I may be wrong there.
I just struggle with any guidance from the ICO.
Yeah, that's true. Mm. But I think it's important for small businesses, because if you start to implement these processes when you're a small organisation, it's a lot easier, you know, to carry that on as you grow. Whereas if you don't really implement a culture of privacy, and by the time you grow, trying to change that culture can be quite difficult.
Much harder. Much harder. Mm. I mean, I was looking at something this week, came into the support desk. This should be an absolute doddle to deal with, right? We are a US company, and we're a controller, and we're processing data in the UK. Do we need to pay the fee and register as a data controller? I thought, that's interesting. So I looked up the fee regulations, can't remember what they're called off the top of my head, and the ICO's guidance was incredibly ambiguous. It basically just, I mean, maybe we're overthinking it, but it basically is you need to pay the fee if you're a controller. So, you know, or on a global scale, you know, there's no notion of geography to it.
Mm.
And nor is there in the regulation, actually. The only kind of implication that one shouldn't register is because you have to register an address of a registered company. And a registered company is defined in the regulations as something registered under the Companies Act 2006. So if you're a US company registered in Tennessee, then you wouldn't be able to register because you wouldn't have the information required. But that's just kind of reading between the lines. So I downloaded the register of fee payers because it's a publicly available file, and it was like massive. It was over a million. So it crashed my Excel because that's all I could load it into. And I had a look through, and there was quite a few organizations, not many, but a few registered in the registered who are in the US, in Dubai, in Finland, in Ireland, in India, and other places as well. I don't know if anybody's got a thought on this, but my overall kind of thought is, well, what is the purpose of the fee? And it's to fund the ISO, but how would they police something on a global basis? You know, so it can't possibly be designed to try and, you know, capture everyone who's caught by the UK GDPR. Is that its purpose? Because it's not part of the UK GDPR, is it? It's a separate thing. It's about funding the ICO. So I don't think it does, but, you know, it should be something that's dead simple to understand, and it isn't.
I suppose they don't expect to be able to police it on a global scale. However, if something was to be flagged up of an organisation and they started an investigation, that was probably when they'd check. And then if they weren't registered, they'd think, you know, probably question it then, I guess.
Well, what they write to companies, don't they, and say you haven't? If you look, the screen company's house, and they write to companies and say you haven't registered. Because I've had one for a dormant company that I'm involved with, and we wrote back to a dormant company. We're only doing exempt processing, you know, company's house stuff, accounts, you know, stuff like that. And that was the end of it. But, you know, they can't possibly go around and look at all the registered organisations across the world, can they? So, but that, why aren't they clear about that on their website? You know, this applies to UK businesses or it doesn't. You know, it just a couple of words, it would have made it a lot easier. But anyway, that was something that came in support desk, which we're gonna have to double check that with the ICO and check that our rationale is right, that, you know, a foreign company isn't required to register. I said a couple, I kind of a bit more interesting. I saw that there was a court decision which is really quite interesting on kind of the line between pseudonymization and anonymization. I'll put that in the chat because that's really useful. You know, there's this kind of background to it, is that it's a kind of European body, and they were disclosing data to Deloitte, and it was totally pseudonymized. And the court was trying to decide whether pseudonymized, you know, whether the fact that was a key that could mean it could be un-pseudonymized, but Deloitte didn't have access to that key, whether that was then personal data or not. So again, really quite interesting and relevant to what we're doing.
Yeah. So, with that in mind, that, you know, that we've got so much news, but we should probably save some of it for our GDPR radio session next week and go into the main bulk of the session. Is that good with you, Phil?
Yeah, sure. Not a problem, yeah. Yet.
So why have we called the session Beyond Consent? Let's start with that.
Well, other than Miles trying to find a catchy title, I feel like you know, I see a lot in the support desk naturally that a lot of data subjects often complain about their personal data being processed without consent. And, you know, and we know that that's not always, you know, the case with lawful processing, is it?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, consent is the one that's most probably well known, especially to those who aren't, you know, don't handle data protection as a job, you know, day to day. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But we tend to stay away from that where possible, don't we, if there is a more suitable lawful basis, just due to the stringent controls around it?
Well, I tell you, when I was doing some reading on this, and it's probably obvious, but it's worth making the point that I'm just putting that link into the anonymization, you stole the punchline, Dr. Jasmine. But the ICO's guidance, which is obvious, isn't it? Once somebody withdraws consent, then you can't rely on any other basic lawful basis. You know, so that again was like, oh yeah, of course that's right, of course it is, isn't it? But that's what they say on their guidance on consent, that if somebody withdraws consent, you can't just switch to a new lawful basis. It. You're up a gum tree without a paddle. Not that a paddle would be much use of a gum tree, but there you go.
I do wonder with that, if you know you're to rely on, if someone withdraws their consent in that instance, but you have a legal obligation to process that personal data, where do you stand then?
Well, according to the ICO, and they're right, you know, if somebody withdraws their consent, is absolute. So the point is, you shouldn't be relying on consent if you've got a better, more appropriate lawful basis for processing. If there is a legal obligation, why have you said consent?
Yeah. No, I think that comes down to, you know, lack of understanding of the law, doesn't it? But it's just something to be careful of, isn't it? It's a tricky one. It is a tricky one.
Vicky's put in the... So I'm just reading this. You carry on chatting. I'm reading this because it's relevant to the thing.
Yeah, well, I was just going to add to what Jasmine said in that when you are trying to determine an appropriate lawful basis, if you're thinking consent or legitimate interest, if you ask yourself, you know, if a data subject exercises the right to withdraw the consent, am I still, you know, do I need to carry on with this processing? And if the answer is yes, then consent is probably not the most appropriate.
Definitely. Well, go on, what's Vicky said, Phil?
No, Vicky said that she had this very same question and asked the ICO, and they said that yes. So presumably that means yes, it is still personal data. The European, in the European intervention, which is the case I was referring to earlier, they said it wasn't. So again, this is kind of some divergence between what we think over here and what the European Data Protection Board think, or wasn't actually the Data Protection Board, is European Data Protection Supervisor, who regulates the European institutions. But again, interesting difference of opinion. But sorry, yeah, back to consent.
No, it's all right. James has said consent is worth avoiding because of the rights conferred on data subjects in local government.
Awesome.
You good?
Keep losing sound.
All right. In local government, it's a rare thing indeed that we used consent, but equally it was pretty rare that we could find someone able to cite chapter and verse of the relevant statute for a legal basis for processing.
So is that in the chat? Yes, it is.
Yeah. And then, like you said, if you must collect vulnerable data because FCA regulator tells you, can you still use legal obligation or must you use consent?
Well, I don't know, because it depends on the FCA what rules and why they're saying that, I suppose. But we'd have to look at that in a bit more detail.
So a question I've got is, you know, this all relates to the first principle of the GDPR: fair, lawful, and transparent processing. Obviously, the lawful element. So if somebody or an organisation breaches another element of the GDPR, does that make the processing unlawful in the eyes of the first principle or not?
That's a good question, because we do refer to non-conformant processing as being unlawful, don't we? We say that's, you know, not lawful processing. I tend to use the non-compliant as a descriptor for that. But there was a recent case, I think we talked about this last week actually, and I think it was in Germany, and the European Court, just again, European stuff, so of interest, but not necessarily of 100% relevance. Mm-hmm. They looked at something. I think there was a breach of retention, I think it was. And they said, you know, just because there's been a breach of other aspects of the GDPR, that is not considered unlawful processing in the context of lawfulness of processing. So I would say no. I would say that, you know, if you've got a breach of the GDPR or other aspects of it, that doesn't mean that data is being processed unlawfully.
Mm. Right. So the only thing that it does apply to is whether the lawful basis is appropriate or not.
Well, it doesn't really link to that, does it, I suppose? Whether the lawful basis is appropriate is a completely separate thing. But if somebody's got a breach, like they haven't done data protection by design by default, or they haven't got ROPAs, you know, does that mean that the process is being processed unlawfully or without a lawful basis? You know, and no, it doesn't. So it's two separate, distinctly separate things.
A confusion in terminology more than anything.
Yeah, but worth raising. It's worth raising, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're talking about when do you have to use consent? Then when is consent mandatory?
Well, direct marketing, electronic direct marketing, because there's a lot of confusion around that, isn't there? I think we'll probably do a session on direct marketing itself, to be fair, because it takes a while to get your head around it. There's a lot to unpick there, but for, you know, sending texts and emails and so on, you need to obtain consent. But there's a paradox with that, isn't there? Because You can't send an email to collect consent to then send direct marketing communications, because that in and of itself is seen as direct marketing itself.
Yeah.
And the ICA, if you remember, the ICA is linked to other things. Well, they say if activities are conducted with the end goal of doing unsolicited direct marketing by email, that's all considered to be part of the same processing activities. So they kind of extend upstream their consideration of whether or not there's been a kind of breach of the packet. So, okay, so if you wanted to send unsolicited direct mail by email or text or electronic messaging, you need consent then. When else do you need consent? Cookies? Need to place on cookies, according to I don't know all this legislative interest is with cookies, but you know, I thought that the regulation was quite clear that consent's required.
Well, I guess unless it's essential cookies, I suppose it maybe didn't specify that.
Yeah. I think the only other one is if you're providing information society services to a child under 16 and you need parental consent. But I think other than that, consent is an option, like on it's a derogation into an international transfer. But in terms of, you know, you have to have consent as lawful grounds. I think there's only those where I can think that they're in the law mandatory, and that might be other guidance and suggestions that consent is you know required. But the GDPR doesn't have anything other than those as far as I can see.
Nabil's asked whether automated calls require consent.
I'd have to double check.
I've not seen anything specified on that one.
I think automated calls might do, actually. Just check my flow chart.
For marketing, yeah.
Yeah. Carry on. I'm going to check the flow chart. I'll stick it in the thing.
Yeah, that's right. Andrew's confirming that. Sorry, Sarah said in the chat, as a not-for-profit provider, our commissioners, such as local government NHS, require us to record certain data items about our clients, so who voluntarily access our services, to evidence service use, and for us to be able to report against the KPI specified. Would this come under contracts? Our contract is with the commissioner, not the client. So
it wouldn't come under a contract. The contract is, you know, between the control and the data subject. So that again could be, you could say that's I think the ICO's view is legal obligation is fairly loose, and I think that's quite helpful to take that stance. So it doesn't have to be a law, that it can be you know, codes of practices and guidelines, and you know, as long as it's got some authoritative substance, I think that they would say that could constitute a legal obligation, or it could be legitimate interest, or you know, depending on where you're sat, it could be a task carried out in the public interest under official authority. So, but definitely not contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So the contract has to be between the data subject and the controller, doesn't it? That's the reliance on the contract, like an employment contract or a tenancy agreement or something like that.
We'll talk about contracts a little bit after, because I want to go into that.
Photographs is a good one, isn't it? I like photographs.
Yeah, taking it back to consent. So typically, you know, if somebody or an organisation supports photographs on of people on a website, or whether it's staff photos or whether it's from, you know, an event that's been run, then we would tend to advise consent for that, wouldn't we? Because
I don't know. Would you?
I think it depends on the context, surely.
Yeah, it depends on the context. I think if it's... maybe less so if it's employees, I'd say.
But if it's school children, you want to put up pictures of the sports day on a website, on a notice board within the school?
No.
What about school trip? No, you put pictures on website, on WhatsApp for the parents? You know, I'm just not sure about, you know, I'm personally not sure, again, throwing it out there for people to kick around and comment on, but I'm not convinced that photos you... absolutely must have consent.
I'm not saying that you absolutely must, but I think there's instances where it's better to do so. Not, this is what I'm saying, so maybe not for employee photos on the website, but for, like you say, you know, pictures of children on the school website, maybe parental consent. Because it's not intrusive, but it's just an extra precautionary measure, isn't it, for something that somebody might feel uncomfortable with. With legitimate interest, you do it, you know, you can rely on it where somebody might reasonably expect their information to be used in that way.
They'd really be expected if the privacy notice tells them that that's what's going to happen. You know, I think that Paul makes a good point. You know, if you would withdraw the picture if someone objected, then consent is appropriate. What if you got a group shot, you know, like a school photo after the whole year? You know, would you use consent there? What if one pupil said, oh, no, I don't want mine? Would you blank them all out? You'd have this year group shot with all these blobs instead of faces.
Yeah. We've actually had something come through the support desk today that is very applicable here, and it got me thinking. I'm actually keen to get your guys' thoughts on this. So a customer of ours are wanting to use staff photos on the website, so people who are complaining are able to put a name to a face and have a more direct conversation with them. They don't want to rely on consent, and instead they believe they could use legitimate interests or performance of a contract. The performance of the contract, it says, you consent to us revealing or publishing personal information about you that is required by the regulator, statutes or related regulations, such as accounting standards, or be obliged by good practice. Failing this, legitimate interest will be the most appropriate. So I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on the most appropriate lawful basis there, because I've got my opinion, but I want to hear from you too.
The scenario is that you've got staff photos and you want to stick them up onto the website for the purpose of printing them off and putting them on a dartboard if you have a complaint. That's kind of paraphrasing what you said there, Joe.
Well, yeah. So if I had a complaint about DPP, for example, I'm going to speak to Jasmine here. I know Jasmine, and I can say, I can have a conversation with Jasmine. Yeah. And
I'm not sure about that. Is it necessary? You know, so...
I tend to agree that for starters, performance of a contract, taking a photo and put it online for that does not meet the consent definition that was in the contract.
Well, it doesn't meet contractual. You know, there's no contract. No, is it a contractual term? You know, you must do this. We have to do that. No, it's not.
No. I don't think. Sorry, go on. Hello.
Nothing.
Oh, sorry. Now I was just going to say, I don't think legitimate interest is appropriate either. I think consent's the best way to go about it. That was my inkling.
Yeah, I mean the ICO says that you should use consent when you know it seems appropriate, and in that case, I think it seems appropriate. You know, but within a school context, you know, some aspects, you know, year group shots, etc., it doesn't seem appropriate to use consent. You know, people still object. You know, and then you'd have to balance up. You know, whether we think that's a valid objection or not, but. Yeah, if in doubt, you know, what's the mechanism? Do a DPIA on it, you know, really explore this and do some consultation with the data subjects. You know, you don't have to sit there and try and make a call as a data protection professional. You can go out into the community and find out what their concerns are. Maybe you put in mitigation. You know? There's lots in the chat. I'm going to scan through the chat. So when do you not use consent? Then there must be a situation where you absolutely shouldn't use consent. Balance of power and all that type of stuff.
Broad question.
when there's no real choice, for example, this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, a lot of the time they say, you know, an employer, you know, shouldn't use.
Yeah, imbalance of power.
Consent because an imbalance of power, you know, the employer, people might feel coerced into consenting to whatever. Mm. I'm not sure about the photo thing, you know, whether you'd feel coerced into consenting anyway. Just reading some of these chat things. Don't schools don't. This is an interesting one that Leslie said. Don't schools use a consent blanket at the start of each term? But again, if it's a blanket, you know, how can it be informed granular consent? You know, it's what people do, but it doesn't feel that it's right. You know, people might feel comfortable because they've got consent, but if the consent is for lots of different things, then it's not going to meet the conditions for consent. In Article 7, is it?
No.
Well, potentially, unless they're all the same type of use.
Yeah. And if you can specify what you don't consent to as well, that's always a good thing to have in a... You know, if you've got a consent form that you're providing consent to allow somebody else to act on your behalf for a tenancy, for example... there might be certain things that you don't want them to be able to discuss or access and so on. So if you've got an open text box that allows people to specify that, that's always good practice.
Yeah. Another interesting angle is, and I think you raised this a minute ago, was how frequently, you know, how long does consent last for? You know, should you be systematically refreshing it on what basis? I remember reading something quite a long time ago where the ICO was in their guidance was saying, if you said we're going to collect your data for a 6-month campaign, you know, for a gym membership, then at the end of that 6-month campaign, you know, the consent is not valid anymore. So how you, I remember thinking, oh, how you word your privacy notices are really critical because you could end up shooting yourself in the foot here, big style. But again, on their website, they say that, you know, you should refresh consent or consider refreshing consent every 2 years. That seems a bit prescriptive, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think they leave it open on purpose, don't they?
Yeah, but that, again, that's not helpful, is it? To people, we're quite happy with these grainers, and I'm sure most of the people on the session are as well. But you know, it's no wonder that the politicians are saying, you know, this is just bad law. You know, we can't make head and the tail of it. It's causing business disruption. Well, it is. It's not the law that's wrong. It's the blooming guidance, I think, that's woolly.
Mm. I think that's a good point. I think, obviously, the session is beyond consent, but there's so much to unpick with consent. So I've just got a quick question before we go down a different route, but what is the difference between consent and explicit consent? Should we talk about that before we move on?
Yeah. Well, what do you think it's the difference?
Well, obviously, I don't... Well, it's, first of all, it's got to meet the requirements of Article 7, hasn't it? So it's got to be freely given, specific, informed, unambiguous, and so on. To my understanding, it's got to be, it's like a stronger consent, isn't it? It's got to be a clear indication that they are consenting to the use of special category data. Aside from that, I was under the impression that it had to be written, but Joe earlier trumped that one.
Yes, trumped my opinion, Phil. So explicit consent, I mean, consent itself has to be a positive action, so a tick in the box, whereas explicit consent is, in my eyes, is more than that. So typically could be a signature of a statement, or it can be collected verbally. However, the controller must keep, you know, a transcript, I guess, of that, or evidence that the individual has explicitly consented to the processing of their special category data.
Yeah, I think it's a subtle difference, isn't it? The kind of word explicit. If consent has to be specific and unambiguous and et cetera, you know, what is special about explicit consent? And, you know, I guess it's a less bundled or a very specific thing, explicit thing you're consenting to. Again, if you've got to have a positive action to indicate consent, you can't ever have implied consent anymore. So all consent presumably must be quite explicitly given, because otherwise you don't meet the standard. But the only two places that explicit consent is referenced is, as you say, Article 9 and also the derogation in Article 49.1, you know, for overseas transfers, restricted transfers. So you can do that on the basis of explicit consent. Again, you would expect that to manifest itself as saying, we are going to transfer this data about you for these purposes to this territory, you know, potentially for this named recipient. And maybe that's just going that there was an extra few steps in it really being really clear on exactly what it is that you're consenting to. Other than that, you know, I think that's really it, isn't it? That's what explicit consent is. But if you're making a consent statement and you have to have much more granularity about specific consent or elements of the consent statement, and you know, allowing people to explicitly consent to those, I think personally it's a bit of a red herring. I think all consent must be explicit, otherwise it doesn't meet Article 7 conditions. Personally.
Mira said in the chat, I think explicit consent should give people a yes or no choice. If we only want to collect data, if they say yes, then it's okay to stop an online form submission if a person chooses no. Is it okay? I am thinking about people consenting to participate in research studies.
I think surely all consent's got to be Boolean yes or no.
Yeah, I was thinking the same.
I'm not. Sure, just reading through that. I'm going to go back up to the question about is there an age from which consent is required? I mean, again, I know chat's quite tricky to kind of type into, but I think I'm not sure what that question is, but certainly parental consent for Information Society Services required for children aged under 13. But the whole thing relates around whether children are competent to give consent. And the ICO has for years said that around the age of 13, they would consider, you know, children to be able to exercise their rights independently of their parents and to consent to processing. So I've got a hand up.
One mirror.
Yeah, it's me. So my question was really to do with, you know, sort of if we're inviting people to submit videos and photos of themselves, and these people are, you know, how can we assess whether they are competent to give their own consent, or do we just go by the blanket? If they're under 18, you get parental consent. It's a difficult one to judge.
What's the scenario? What are these?
So we're going to have an event and we're inviting people to submit photos and videos to share in social media. So obviously we want consent to share that, the photo and videos in social media. But thinking about how we collect the videos, do we only allow adults to submit them? Do we allow people under 18 to submit them? And then in which case, how do we collect this consent, and how do we assess if somebody is under 18 that they are able to consent?
Yeah, that's the age verification is a really tricky one at the moment. What are they consenting to?
Sharing the images and videos in social media.
Yeah, so you could just not use consent. You could say, again, back to the question about, you know, is consent the most appropriate lawful basis for photographs and social media stuff? But you could say, Leo, if you submit a thing, we're going to use it, you know, without consent. So what you're doing isn't an information society service. So it's not caught by Article 8 of the GDPR. There's a definition of what an information society service is, and what your suggestion, it doesn't kind of fall within that definition. So you don't have to use consent, I guess, is what we're saying. So
yeah,
you could just, you know, again, it depends what you're saying in your privacy notice to people, but and without knowing the ins and outs of it, it's hard to kind of stick our neck out, but we do like sticking our neck out on this thing.
Interesting. So
it sounds to me like I'd be exploring whether consent is best, or whether you'd be better off using religious interest, because people can still object, you know, later on they could say, actually, can you take that down? And you'd say, yeah, of course we can.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you, Phil, because if the individual didn't want the video to be used, they wouldn't post it in the first place.
The thing you've got to be careful of is people posting videos of other people. That would be my main worry there, I think. Mm. But then you might have to, you know, you might have to, as part of that, say, you know, and you are confirming that you've got permission from those individuals featuring that video. But I mean, anybody within a video would then be caught by that legitimate interest claim, wouldn't they? And,
that's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, it is, and therefore, if it's a challenge, you wouldn't get consent from all those people, then it doesn't feel like it's right. Either it's not right to do the processing, which it probably is, or the consent bit isn't right. It just doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, happy to kind of talk about this outside of the podcast, mm-hmm. but you know, if you've got, I think I'd be checking whether or not lawful ground, the law consent is the best lawful basis for this.
Okay, thanks.
No worries. I think Michael's got his hand up as well, if you'd like to unmute.
Yeah, I was just going to say, based on what you just said about deletion, for example, like, I think a very good point with everything that everyone's asking is that if you're talking about the consent and the, you know, the transparency of when you're collecting the consent for the person and promising to potentially delete it, as you just said, with social media, it's kind of too late. Like I said, you post it, you can't promise on behalf of a huge organization like Facebook that they are going to remove it if they request for a right to forgotten or something. So I think sometimes it's good to put like a reference to the retention of what you're going to be keeping, mm-hmm. or what they're posting. You know, for example, I had someone who said, I want to post images to improve medical care for awareness and that sort of thing. And I said, well, you can't promise anybody that they can actually delete it. So they should be aware at the beginning that whatever they give you will probably be on there permanently. It could be unposted, but it will still be there and shared potentially. And you can't make a promise, otherwise you're send your safety file.
Yeah, it's very tricky. I mean, there is that obligation of, you know, to inform onward processes of a deletion request, but you know whether that actually works in practice or not, I don't know.
Mm.
I mean, as an example, we did a press release this week, and we just put it into one journal. And it ended up being on two separate Twitter accounts and three separate, I think it was Facebook or LinkedIn accounts, wasn't it, Miles? So, you know, there's a proliferation of the same content, you know, the same picture of us, you know, and the same the same text. You know, it's really hard to track it down and to, as you say, pinpoint it and erase it down the line. Once it's out, isn't it?
Yep,
Jasmine,
you
were wanting to... You were itching to get off consent. I don't know why.
Well, I was thinking it's called Beyond Consent, isn't it? And we've not really touched much on what is Beyond Consent. I think this it's quite ironic in the way, you know, that we say probably to avoid consent if it's not needed, but we always end up with
ICO
background
that,
to it.
Yeah, even the ICO's guidance says that, you know. Looking at it on the screen here, they even say that. So it's recognised as being potentially, you know, tricky because it's such a high bar, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, aside from consent, what is the, you know, I think you we've got the other lawful basis of legal obligation, legitimate interest, performance of a contract, vital interest, and public task. I think obviously public task you only see where it's for organisations acting in. You know, as a public authority or a public body, etc. But aside from that, why do we gravitate towards consent? Why not legitimate interests?
That's the acid question. That's an absolutely, you know, cutting question, isn't it? And
yeah,
it's a good one because I was looking at something with Caitlin in the week, and one of our clients wanted a general consent form, so you know they would then fill in, you know, we're doing this, you know, and within the framework of a standard form. And I was thinking, well, that's encouraging everyone to gravitate towards consent rather than thinking it through. And I don't know. I think that there's this preconception that you need permission. We get so many complaints from, well, not complaints, but questions through the support desk saying, you know, customer is complaining we haven't got their consent to do this.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we don't need their consent. You know, you're processing based on legitimate interest or, employment law or something. But there's this whole notion, I don't know where it's come from, that you can't process people's personal data without consent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't new, is it? It's been around since at least 1989 in the old Data Protection Act.
It's a bit before our time, that, Phil.
Moving on.
But again, it's a great question.
Come back.
It's a great question, Jasmine. Why? Who's got that preconception, and why have they got it?
I think the public just do. I think you just tend to just think that, oh, you can't do that unless I've told you can do that. I don't think the public. I mean, I speak for myself. Before I joined data protection people, I didn't really have any sort of inkling as to what the GDPR was. I didn't understand any other lawful basis. I just kind of assume that people can't do things with my data unless they have my permission to do so. It just makes sense,
maybe,
doesn't it?
You see, that's what you said there, I think, reinforces it. You said my personal data, and we talk about people's, you know, their personal data, his personal, her personal, and that's not how the law characterizes it. It says it's personal data is information relating to somebody who's identifiable, et cetera, et cetera. So I usually avoid at all costs referring to his personal data, her personal data, my personal data, their personal data. I say personal data relating to the data subject. Again, I think that the use of that pronoun encourages everyone to think that it's yours, you own it, you know, and you don't.
Mm. I've got a question about performance of a contract. So on the face of it, it seems straightforward, you know, if as long as the controller's got a contract with the data subject, whether it's, you know, an employment contract or a tenancy agreement or something along those lines, and the processing is necessary for the fulfillment of that contract or steps to enter into it, then, you know, you can rely on it, aside from whatever you're thinking, Phil. But I had a conversation a while ago with Ollie about when you can rely on performance of a contract. So a charity was ones who provide support services to families with you know, very young children under the age of three, wanting to rely on performance of a contract, the contract being the registration form or sign-up form to these services, but it's a free service. And I missed a bit of contract law in uni because it was in first year and I had other priorities.
You're
but yeah,
consideration.
So
other priorities.
For those that don't know much about contract law, there are 4/5 requirements for a contract to be valid. So it's offer and acceptance. What are the others?
Consideration.
Consideration and intention to create legal relations. But it's the consideration element. So that would be giving a pound and receiving a pound.
Or a peppercorn. Anything.
Or a peppercorn.
You ever heard of a peppercorn rent?
No.
A contract where the fee for the license, the tenancy was one peppercorn per year.
I thought you had steak on your mind, Phil, wanting a peppercorn sauce.
No, but back in when Charles Dickens was a lad and me and him used to kick round the block together, as you know, I'm very old. You too.
No comment.
I think you're overthinking it personally. I think that the performance of the contract or steps to enter into it, you know, I personally don't think you know, that it would exclude a legally binding
agreement. Is a registration form legally binding? No, you know, it's literally just providing your details, what service you want, tick, I've read the privacy policy, whatever's on it. Is that a contract?
Well, I don't know. Again, there's one of the definitions of a contract is it has to have, you know, substantive provisions, doesn't it? So, you know, the intention to bind the parties, if that's what the intention of the registration form is. Because you can have a verbal contract, can't you? So, you know, if you can have a verbal contract, then why would the registration form not be a contract? If it was sufficiently well worded, then it would be, wouldn't it? Could be, anyway.
I think I remember looking at it and it wasn't sufficiently well worded.
To be honest, I
don't know. Ollie at the time was under the impression of why isn't this a contract? I don't think there's a reason why it shouldn't be. But that consideration element, there's no payment of pounds or peppercorns involved. It's a free service. It's literally just signing up. I don't understand how.
I don't know enough about contract law myself, but maybe the consideration can also be a non-material consideration. You know, if a peppercorn can also be consideration as well as pound sterling, then maybe, you know, some kind of action or in could also be. We'd have to double check with a contract lawyer.
James has said in the chat, verbal contract not worth the paper it's written on.
Quite agree. Although one of the parties will write it down or record it to try and capture them out. Now, we talked at the end of last session very briefly about the proposed changes in the Data Protection Bill number 2, didn't we, about lawful grounds for processing. Because we talked about why there's Article 6 of 5, is it 6, AE, that's inserted and it introduces the concepts of, recognised legitimate interests.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a proposal to put in another lawful basis for processing, doesn't it?
Yeah, we spoke about this last week, didn't we? It's a bit confusing. I don't know why they're differentiated, really. If it's all within the remit of legitimate interest, it doesn't really make sense to me.
Surely it's a legitimate interest if it's a recognised one. What's the point of this distinction between the two?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure, but Annex 1 in the Keeling Schedule, anyway, of the Data Protection Number 2 Bill has got a list of six situations where, you know, it is a recognised legitimate interest. But there are obvious stuff like national security, emergencies, crime, democratic engagement, you know, but also safeguarding vulnerable individuals. Now, that seems to me to be exactly the same as DPA Schedule 1, Section 18, you know, the safeguarding individuals. We haven't even got onto these yet. These are well beyond consent, aren't they?
Yeah.
which we need to get on with them in the next 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
I think we should have a second session on this, to be honest. Maybe in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, there's a danger. Well, to me, there's danger in that, you know, of this stuff kind of getting duplicated. You know, if we've got these safeguarding of individuals as an annex one to the data protection bill, you know, to the GDPR or wherever it is, then, you know, what if it doesn't quite sit at some point with, you know, is it adding more confusion because it's replicating the in the DPA? as a substantial public interest rather than a legitimate interest.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Yeah, I think I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way around it, really, but it just adds more confusion, to be honest. I think even already it's a lot for people to take in. So you've got, but let's say when it comes to special category data, you've got your Article 6 basis that you need, then you've got your Article 9 basis, then you've got Schedule 1 on top of that, and it's like just
that all makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, there's a slight anomaly of criminal convictions and offences, which again we should be talking about, but we haven't had time. But Clara has backed me up saying that she belongs to a group where the rental is still a peppercorn year if requested. So it might not even be requested by the landlord.
Maybe this is the new currency.
Except they're not cheap, are they?
We understand it. We work with it very closely, but it is a lot of back and forth, and even so, obviously Schedule 1, it covers substantial public interest, but there's also provisions in there for social employment, social security, social protection law as well.
Is it split into three parts?
Lawful basis can, the whole schedule or parts 1 to 3 it can apply to, whereas other parts it's only covered under part 1, and then criminal offence data is also in there, but then there's further provisions into part 3. Like, it's
you do have to step through it. Yeah, because the exemptions also in Article 23 are listed in Schedule 2, aren't they? So you have to be able to step through it. And, when you do pull it all apart, start reading through particular Data Protection Act, Section 10, is it? That it starts setting out, Article 9.2G, Article 9.2B, refer to this part of the schedule. So you need that to decode it, and then you have to then go into the schedules to have a look at it. But it honestly makes absolute perfect sense.
I think it's conviction just data. Typical English law, UK law, where it's, I think it just seems to be a little bit overcomplicated. It does make sense, and I quite enjoy that part of the law, to be honest. But, trying to digest it, it can be tricky.
Well, you need quiet space and some cups of coffee there sometimes.
I agree. The Data Protection Act is a bit of a nightmare to, get to grips with. But, Jasmine, the government are changing the UK GDPR. So I don't think the UK GDPR is... I don't think there's a problem with it the way it reads. I think it's pretty easy to understand, but you're right in that the Data Protection Act is a bit of a nightmare, isn't it? But
I mean, my rant wasn't even supposed to be about that. I'm just, like you say, the UK GDPR reads well, it's clear, it's structured, it flows, everything. And it's just our stance on it, our mark on it, that I feel like, something that we don't need. Ours in the government's, but yeah. Michael's got his hand up.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just wanted to say, you've got some good points, and one of the things I think the ICO has really struggled with is actually making people aware what entails or what the rights are for people, and that's something that's always been a target of theirs. But I've spoken to so many people who don't know what it is, but there are people from outside the country who make requests for information, for example. They seem to have a better understanding of what their rights are than we are sometimes, and I think that'd be helpful, because I've had requests from people who think that when you talk about names, you've breached their GDPR. So, I mean, if that heavy understanding is something the public see, I imagine the types of queries they must get across all these organizations where it could be completely and utterly not relevant, but everybody has to manage that fallout. So it does create a lot of work. I mean, you will only have a negative view of freedom of information requests and environmental requests if you dealt with them for years because of that very reason. So anyway.
Yeah. I mean, strategically, to head off that at the pass in the longer term, then the ICO, if they created a really good, decisive guidance, and it would become clearer to people, but some of it is just very hard to understand. I can't remember when it was now, a few months ago, I got asked to go and attend a focus group on the new ICO's website, and I said, you know, you've got this bit, it's for organizations and for people, but there's nothing really for practitioners. You know, you take down all the enforcement action after a period of time. You know, we want to go back and look at that because we want to find out, you know, what why you made certain decisions. And your guidance for people and for organizations, we want more detail. You know, but anyway, I think they've ignored my suggestions. but I thought that would be really useful to have a section of the ICS website for privacy practitioners, which is, you know, much better, you know, and maybe a different support team. Anyway, that's just what do I know.
So have the updates to the ICS website come?
I don't know, honestly.
I don't know. Right, I'll stay tuned for that one. Well, that is the end of the session anyway.
We haven't even talked about personal data relating to criminal conviction and offences. We've not got into tracking data, substantial public interest conditions. And you know, so I think we'll potentially have to put another session on just to that. And again,
I think we should.
I think it might be quite useful to just kind of go through, maybe put a couple of slides together to show, I don't know, if I'm sucking eggs and all that kind of stuff, then by all means, tell me to get lost. But, you know, we could then step through how the whole thing relates and flows. Yeah. Michael, yeah, hands up again. Visual. Unless it's still up.
No, I just don't think it's come down. So our next week's session is on GDPR radio session. Miles will put the content calendar out, you know, within the next week or so of what sessions are coming after that. So, yeah, there will be a second session coming. Stay tuned. But apart from that, thank you all for joining and have a great weekend.
Thank you all very much.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye.